This time, please help me welcome our speaker. It's Billy F. from Phoenixville Clubhouse.
Hello, everybody. My name is Billy. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Billy.
It's good to be back out here in Quakertown. I think that's where I'm at. It's been about 3 years, I think, so I was out this way. Let me move closer. There we go. My sobriety date's December 27, 2002. As my buddy mentioned, my home group's the Phoenixville Clubhouse. And I do have a sponsor that I still work with today. His name's Tim C. from Collegeville. And I'm sponsoring a few guys these days. But I'm going to do my best to tell you what it was like, what happened, and what it's like today. I always got to remind myself, like, I don't prepare for these things. I just say a prayer and say, you know, God, help me. Whatever needs to come out, please help it come out. You know what I mean? And I'm not here to sound good. I'm just here to, you know, be honest, tell you the truth, and tell you the best how I can remember how things went down. But I grew up in a sober house. Never saw my father drink. My mother never drank either. I think my father got sober in 77. And I grew up in a sober house. And I always say, like, I don't think my alcoholism was a result of my environment, because I never saw anybody drinking. And my dad, I was one of five children. I got four nutty sisters, and dad would come home from work and immediately go out with his buddies to these meetings. And I always kind of felt like I was left on my own with the women. For me growing up, you know, I started drinking in my teens as a result of hanging out with my sisters. My parents would go away and my sisters would throw wild parties. And I remember sitting on the counter just watching all these people smiling and dancing and music blasting thinking how neat this was, you know what I mean? I had a couple of drinks. I can't tell you if I got drunk or anything like that, but I remember I felt something from the atmosphere, and it was something I wanted. Growing up, once I started drinking, living in my father's house, he wasn't having it, because I was the guy, when I was drinking, like, bad stuff happened. I was the kid that got caught all the time. When I threw the parties, when it was my turn to carry the torch, I would always end up with three local cops, six stateies, and a canine unit in the driveway. And I'd have to feel the wrath of my father when he would come home. Multiple car accidents while I was in high school. I remember my 17th birthday. You know, we did 80 miles an hour into a tree. People were medevaced and seriously injured. And I walked away from the accident, I remember. And they were saying, because I was so drunk, I just was just like jello. I just bounced off everything and climbed out the sunroof. I remember laying in the hospital, waiting for them to, you know, work on me, but I was under 18, so they needed my parents' permission, so they would be calling home. Finally, when my dad answered, he's just like, nah, my son's, he's in bed. He's like, no, he's not. We got him up here. And I remember that he came into the hospital room, and he just said, happy birthday, son. And he turned around, and he left after he signed the papers. He never said I was an alcoholic. He never said I'm going to take you to any meetings. I'm grateful for that, because when the time came for me, like, I knew where to turn to, for me, I was thrown out at the age of 18, I had the ego, like, I'll show you, I don't need you, I don't need anybody, I can do this thing on my own. And I left home, fell into the hotel business somehow along the way, and I lived on a little island in Michigan. It was called Mackinac Island. And I was 20 years old, moved to this island, and this is where my alcoholism really took off. I had some minor blackouts here and there, but it wasn't like it was a daily thing, but it was always kind of like later in the evening. And but once I hit the island, I stepped off the ferry, and it looked like an old Western town. It was nothing but bicycles, horses, and bars. There was no cars on the island. I went down the street to this hotel, lived in a dorm with 300 English, Irish, and Scottish students. They were all studying hospitality from overseas, and it was a pretty wild time. We worked breakfast, lunch, and dinner around the clock, 60 to 100 hours a week. I was about 120 pounds. My daily routine, like, I never drank in the morning, but I was usually still drunk when I came to. And I'd end up, it would be coffee and smokes till noon, eat a little bit off a buffet after, you know, we cleared some tables. And I'd always have these intentions of taking it easy and staying in that night, you know, and try to get some rest. But whatever would happen, you know, around dinner time, something would happen. Everybody's like, where are we going tonight? You know, and I'd just be ready to go again. You know, we start polishing off the drinks off the tables. I go down to the dorm. I'd stop and drink with the Irish kids. I'd stop and drink with the Scottish kids. I'd be blasted by the time I got to my room, changed, go out, steal a bike, and then, like, ride downtown. And living in these resort towns, you know, it wasn't like, you know, people on vacation when they're in these places, and everybody's cutting loose, and I was cutting loose every night. And you didn't just buy a drink. You bought a fishbowl of liquor, and there was just like 6-7 straws in it, and everybody just like stick their head in. And I would never remember leaving. I remember a lot of times at this point my employers would call me in, you know, or I'd be 2 hours late for work. But, you know, what's 2 hours late in a 16-hour day? You know, I would justify that, and you know, they need me. They're not going to do nothing. And my boss would call me in, and he's like, they're like, you stink like booze. You know, stay away from the guests for a while. You know, can't you just take it easy? You know, we would cater anywhere between 6 to 11 weddings every Saturday. Like, half of Michigan got married on this island, and it was nuts. And I would run around doing stuff, and I would just collapse, and I'd get knocked, whack my head off a table, get a concussion here or there, and they'd send me to the med center, and the doctors would ask me, how much are you drinking? And I would be just like, you know, not any more than anybody else on this island. And they would say, you're dehydrated. You need to get other fluids in your system other than booze, and you need to eat some food. And going back, you know, back to the resort, like, it was kind of like the badge of honor. Work hard, play hard. You know, that was the motto. I was young. I was just 21. But I'd have good, you know, I'd have these intentions to try to manage my drinking, because I spent 5 years on this, 5 summers on this island, because in the wintertime, the lake freezes over, and they shut the whole place down. But I was employee of the year 2 years in a row the first 2 years I was there, out of like 600 employees. I was special. I was manager 1 year. I failed a drug test. They called me in the office. They said, Billy, this never happened. You're too important of a person here at this place. We can't afford to lose you. Everybody, all the kids here, they look up to you. You can't say nothing because we get in a lot of trouble. Right there told me, they say, you know, anybody's expendable or replaceable. Well, everybody but me, you know, that's where my head went to. My ego was huge, and which drove me further. Like, I was the egomaniac with the inferiority complex. Always had to prove, always had to be better than everybody else. Always had to be seen, noticed. Always had this chip on me. I'd send the awards back home to mom and dad. See, look at me, I'm doing just fine. And then, over here, this is all going well with work, kinda. But over here, still, the drinking thing, getting the talkings to, the hospital visits here and there. They would turn a blind eye here and there with a lot of stuff. I'd get in trouble with the cops, and things were kind of getting taken care of. And I would go out. The insanity wasn't all the crazy stuff that I did out there. I think about it. I'd go out. I'd have those intentions to not go out, like staying in the night. Or when I did go out, it's just like, man, I'm just going to drink Bud Light because I black out when I drink Captain Morgan's. And all those crazy thoughts that I hear people sharing about. Like, I had all these novel ideas how I was going to manage my drinking, And I would go out, and I remember times I'd go to take that drink, and it was like, here we go. Like, I knew it was on. And they call last call, and I'd get, like, this panic would come over me. Like, colds, like I'm not there yet. Whatever there is, I'm not there, for me, started to decline pretty quick. And they would transfer me to different resorts every winter because the place would shut down. And everywhere I went, I said, it's going to be different. I'm going to eat some food. I'm going to lift some weights. I'm going to get this under control, save some money. I didn't pay for rent, didn't pay for food. I made a hell of a lot of money. And I had just enough at the end of every season to get me from, like, there to the next place. And everywhere I went, it's going to be different, and it wouldn't take long. I lived in Wisconsin for 10 days. It used to be, back in 98, it used to be Hugh Hefner's first Playboy mansion. They converted it into, like, this big ski resort. And I moved into it used to be the bunny huts. They had these cabins out in the woods. And I was there 10 days. I had a plan. Always had a plan. Went out drinking that night, and I drove. And on the island, you rode a bike or you walked, or most nights they'd push me home in a cart. But I drove that night, and I drank like I always drank, into oblivion. And I remember coming out of a blackout, can't move my arm. There's a tow truck out in the where my truck is supposed to be parked, and I find out the cops are looking for me. And as things get pieced together after I talk to the police, I was driving home in a blackout in a blizzard and got my truck stuck in a drift, and then went into some place and stole a tow truck to get home. And somehow I broke my arm while I was stealing the tow truck. Good enough to get a titanium plate and 6 screws in my arm, and stopped for hot dogs on the way home too at the gas station, because the gas station guy remembered me and I had to do some time for that. And I remember calling my mother from a Wisconsin prison, not being able to tell her what happened, and she's crying, and I'm thinking she's like, probably reliving, because I heard horror stories about what my dad put her through, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to do that to her, And he gets on the phone, and it was always the same story with him. Like, how much do you need? Probably $3,500 for an attorney. I'll put it on your tab. And that was like our interaction. And then as soon as I would, get out of trouble, I'd make that money back, write him that check, and just be like, we're even. But I always called him, And I remember thinking, I need to get this thing under wraps, because that's pretty bad, what just went down, but I ain't doing that AA crap, I'm not like him, I'm tougher than him, I don't need anybody's help, and so I remember I went back that one year, and I hung out in bars every night, drank Coca-Cola with the lime, minus Bacardi, And I met a girl, and I figured a girl relationship will keep me straight till, you know. And the girl would always ask me, like, how come you never have a drink with me? And I tell her, you know, I don't want you to see how I get. Like, I become somebody else. And I'm like, I'm showing her, I'm like, I got scars all over my body, and I got no stories to go with them. My dad used to joke, you know, he'd come out of a blackout and there'd be another kid, you know, and that's how it was for him. But like, the apple doesn't fall too far from the tree, because I come out of blackouts and it's like, it's fallout, you know. And you know, for me, like with the, you know, she just, I wasn't in the bar. I was just home with the girl one night in a good mood, and that insanity comes over me. You know, I'm an alcoholic. You know what? You have the voice in my head's telling me, you know what, Billy? You haven't drank in 6 months. You know, you're good now. You can have two. You know, it was always that voice that would tell me, you know what? You haven't drank for 30 days, because I have all the time. The insanity, the voice in my head would tell me. Alcoholism, saying, it's okay, Billy, you can have that drink. And I would take that drink, and that girl ran for the hills. And it would never take me very long, you know. I was living in Panama City Beach. My employers told me, like, Billy, maybe this is a good time for us to part ways. I got offered a position in Panama City Beach as a director of catering. 25 years old. I had arrived. They had big name performers. I had like a staff of 60, responsible for like $3 million in revenue a year. And I love telling people that I had no college education either. Like, I did this, I did all this on my own, you know. Like, I was so full of myself. And down there, six months. I remember sitting on my couches. Sitting on my leather couches, I lived two blocks from the Emerald Coast, they called it, the Gulf of Mexico, and I'm drinking myself stupid, thinking, what's wrong? There's something's not right. The truck's paid for, it's out front, got this two-bedroom apartment, or half a house to myself, all this brand-new furniture, giant TV, girlfriend, like, something's not right, like something's missing, you know, and I couldn't figure it out, you know, and I remember, and it wasn't until after I came to AA when I was talking to somebody about that, a lot of wise dudes, old dudes in AA, this one guy said to me, he said, Billy, you have a God-shaped hole in you, and you try to fill it with booze and drugs and girls and things. And you will never be complete. You'll never be filled. There's only one thing that can complete or fill a God-shaped hole. And he also said, you suffer from the disease of more. You know, it's never enough. You know, after you might buy stuff for yourself, and then it might make you feel pretty good for a little bit. You know, and then you need something new, because it kind of stops working for you. And you start going back and forth and back and forth And for me, you know, that just it described me perfectly in the way I lived and felt. And I was down there, and at that point, the booze had me. I just went into work. I was going through the motions, and I was driving home, and I was two blocks from my house in the middle of spring break. Mind you, it's the spring break capital of the United States. You know, I'm driving past the Girls Gone Wild house, the MTV towers over here, Club La Vila, and then blackout. And then I come out of this blackout, and I'm standing on the side of my truck, because it was flipped over on its side, and there's a woman laying next to my truck. And there was somebody already there on the scene. And they just looked up at me as I'm standing on my truck, and she just looked up at me and she said, man, she's gone. And I can't tell you what I felt. I just went numb. I just came out. It was like the thoughts in my head, you know, it just said, it's all gone. You know, it's over. Everything you've worked for, it's done, you know. for a minute there, I just thought about running. And I'm just like, you ain't going nowhere. Like, your truck's here. You're done. So I went and sat on the side of the road and waited for the cops to come get me. And what happened was I was coming home from work, obviously blasted, and this fellow was on a motorcycle, and he picked up a girl at the bar, and they were drinking, no helmets, and that guy died on the way to the hospital. So a lot of question whose fault the accident was. And that's all I needed was an excuse. I remember they took me to the hospital. They took my blood. They released me. And 6 months later, they charged me 2 counts of DUI manslaughter. And it's pretty much over. And so I remember in that first month, I was just kind of going to work, just trying to stay out of myself, staying busy. And I would go home and lock myself in the house till the next day. And people always say, Billy, it wasn't your fault. They hit you. And that's all. I just need people to co-sign my, you know, my BS. And I started drinking again. And when I drink as an alcoholic, booze calls the shots. So I'm coming out of blackouts and other people's wheels, going out for smokes or whatever. And because that's how I do it when I drink. And that I went on for like a year like that. I'd go to hearings. Is this the day they're going to take me away? I'd be still drunk going in there. And hungover and just wondering when it was going to, you know, when it was going to come to an end. And after a really bad, it was like a three-day bender, I found myself on the floor. You know, I was either face this thing drunk and scared or sober with maybe a little bit of hope. And because the way I was going to kill somebody else or kill myself. And I called my father. And I got to mention this too. Like, for me to be on the crying out, it was pretty much, please God help me, you know. I didn't believe in God. I had 12 years of Catholic school. I'm a good alcoholic. You try to jam anything down my throat, I run the other way. You know what I mean? I shut that door tight. I was forced to be an altar boy. I remember like being up on that altar, like that, the fear that I'd always feel, like everybody's watching me. I'm going to ring the bells at the wrong time. And I went to school there at the time, the nuns used to put their hands on you, you know. I probably deserved it, but still, you know, I'd get a whooping. And all that stuff made me, you know, hate anything about religion and God and all that stuff. And I used to say, God's for weak people, you know, like Mom. Well, I guess I was beaten down in such a weakened state that I was crying out for help. And in the big book, it talks about deep down inside every man, woman, and child, there's some kind of fundamental understanding of God. I think it's in there. And I think that's what it was. Like, my God in there was saying, all right, it's time, you know. And I think I had to drink every drink. And for me, I called my father, and he said, I hope it's not too late, son, you know. And he said, I want you to do something, because work sent me to AA before, and I went just to keep them off my back for a little bit. And you guys said a lot of good stuff too, and I took a lot of it. And I figured, all right, I'm good, you know, I can do this on my own. And my dad said, I want you to do something. He's like, you got to get a sponsor, and not one of these guys that you can work over, like you can manipulate people. Someone that's going to kick your ass and keep you in line. And so I went to a meeting the next day, and I sat at this long table, and it was noontime, and there was nobody, there was no young people getting sober in Panama City Beach. I mean, I think the person with the youngest sobriety probably had 20 years, because everybody down there were snowbirds, they call them, were retirees from, you know, up north. And so it was me, and Yeah, I was the young buck in there. But they asked if there was any newcomers, and I didn't say nothing, and they all turned and looked down in my direction. And I'm thinking, how do they know I've never been here before? And then I heard this guy start sharing, and I'm thinking, oh my God, like that's the guy I'm supposed to go talk to. Like, he just seemed kind of threatening, maybe in a way. He looked like, I described him as looking like Jesse Ventura. He was a retired union steel worker from Brooklyn who had worked on the Trade Center back in the day. He used to tell stories how he'd be drunk and he'd be falling stories in between like rebar and not dying. And this guy, he was a Vietnam vet with the Harley parked out back. And I went up to him after the meeting, and I said, I'm looking for a sponsor. And he just said, yes, so. And I had to humble myself, you know. I believe God puts people in our path. And I needed some serious ego deflating, and there was nobody better than Leo. And I asked him, will you be my sponsor? And he said, yes. And he said, I want you to get here every day at 11 o'clock for this 12 o'clock meeting and help me open up, make coffee. And I said, whoa, slow down. You don't understand. I'm a pretty important guy down here at this resort, and I don't think I can get here every day. And then that's when it started in with me. He said, boy, I know who you are. I read the newspapers. And he said, you need nothing short of a miracle to get your ass out of what you're in. And he said, you're going to get here every day, and you're going to help me open up, and you're going to help me make coffee. There ain't going to be no job to go back to. And Leo said they are suggestions, but it's just like when you jump out of an airplane, I suggest you pull the ripcord. Because if you don't do what I tell you, you're done. And that's pretty much how he talked to me. But I'd be in a meeting, and they would say, if you need to get up and get some coffee or use the bathroom, go ahead. And I'd get up in the middle of the meeting, get some coffee, go to the bathroom. Afterwards, he'd jack me up and said, what are you doing? Getting up, doing a meeting, you know? And I'd be like, they told me I could go. And he's like, you don't understand. He's like, there's newcomers in this room, and there's people that need to be listening, you know, and you're a distraction, you know, when you get up. You know, I don't realize this stuff because I'm so self-absorbed and self-centered, and I do things based on what I want to do. And I had to start learning about being considerate of others and being in service to others. You know what I mean? And this guy taught me a lot. And he sent me home with the big book. And he said, read the doctor's opinion. Of course, I didn't read the doctor's opinion the first night, so I caught heat for that. But when I read it, I remember reading, the part about the director. And about, you know, running the show and if arranging the lights. And if everybody would just do and act as I want them to, my show would go off perfectly. And that's how I felt. Like, oh my God, this is like, I'm reading this. I'm like, this book's crazy. You know what I mean? Like, it's talking about me. Like I started, I never really thought about it. You know what I mean? I went to AA before and never read the, I didn't know it was a 12-step program. Really, I thought you just drank coffee and sat in meetings, and I started working the steps with Leo, and we got up to up to a fifth step with him before I got my deal. They offered me 30 months in prison. 30 months in prison, 12 and a half years probation, $30,000 in funeral expenses, 100 hours of community service a year on probation, and never drive again, ever. And where do I sign? Because I'm not good, a gambler. And go in front of a jury and mention some of the other substances that were in my blood too, they would have sent me up the river. So in, I think it was March of 2003, I went along the Alabama state line and worked in Florida's finest chain gang for the next 2+ years. And it was an experience. I believe some people need to be locked away to really understand you know, if I'd gotten off, I don't like doing the what if stuff, but I don't know if I'd be sober today if they hadn't locked me up. I got slapped on the wrist plenty of times, and you know, I'm a firm believer that you know, jail works. And and for me, I worked on the chain gang, and it was backwoods, dirt roads, Confederate flags flying. It was something out of a movie. I didn't know these places still existed. And it was tough, you know, going in. You're thinking, you know, the whole rest of the world's going on, and you're just in this, like, limbo, like, you know. And for me, they called AA that first time I was in there, and or that first week. And I'm thinking, you know, am I going to do this? You know, and then the thoughts are coming, you know, why don't you just wait till you get out, you know, like those thoughts. And then it was just like, without thinking, because when I can think myself at anything. You know, I was taught, just take action. You know what I mean? So they called AA. I didn't care who was watching or whatever. I went down to the chow hall where they're having this AA meeting. And I walked in there, and there's this guy sitting there, and he said, finally. And I was like, what do you mean? He's like, I've been coming here for a few months now, and you're the first person that's ever come to the meeting. And this guy drove 2 hours to this prison, sat for an hour, nobody would show up, and then he'd drive home 2 hours every Friday. And I'm thinking, dude, I would have gave up on that after the first time nobody showed up. And but that's how the people in my early sobriety were. Like the lengths that they went to carry the message, or to even be there in case somebody showed up to carry the message, like they set the bar high as far as service. And Leo and his sponsor, Jerry, would drive 2 hours and visit me once a month. There was a bunch of guys. And I was only in that meeting for like 6 months. And these people, like, you know, they loved me till I was able to love myself. And they said, you know, put us on your phone list. And I'm thinking, you know, that's like $15 a call. Like every night I'm calling somebody and I'm like, yeah, I'll pay you back. You know, and they're like, this isn't how this works. You know, you take care of the next guy that comes up the pike behind you, you know. And they sent me literature. And I used to have a lot of problems, a lot of this. The guilt and the shame, you know, having people's lives on my conscience. And I remember this guy, Dennis, who's not here anymore. And he used to say he was a monk in some kind of religious order for like 33 years. And he used to always say to me, you know, Billy, I had religion for 33 years, but I didn't find spirituality until I came to the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was the guy I went to when I was like, Dennis, I can't, you know. It was crushing me. And he said, Billy, you don't know what God's plan is for you. Maybe those two people had to die in order for you to go on to help three other people live, who in turn might go help, you know, two other people live, and, you know, each, you know. And whether that's true or not, it helped me sleep at night. And I think of that every day, you know, what, you know, being on this side of the fence. You know what I mean? Because every day I think about it, I should still be sitting on that rack, digging ditches, chopping down trees, because that's where I belong. And but I remember, I mean, people just, some of my sponsees bust my chops and say, you know, prison time doesn't count as sober time, but because you're locked away, you know, they give me hell. But you know, we'd be out digging ditches or picking up trash, and the boss man would drive down the dirt road, and this is like 6:30 in the morning, and you come up on a 12-pack of beer, you know, glistening in the dew on the side of the road. And there was a system where everybody would grab beers, and the boss man probably knew there was beers there, and maybe that's why he drove ahead. Doesn't really matter. But when it came to that time, you know, I didn't take the beer. You know what I mean? And it was just as easy to get stuff in there as it was out here. You know what I mean? And if not easier, you know, and if you're not in the right mental state in there, you could cave, you know, in a second. And I've seen guys in there do it. And I met a lot of kids in there. they killed their brother, killed their girlfriend, drinking and driving. And I'm just thinking, you know, that could have been, you know, even me with my story being in there, like, but for the grace of God, that could be me. I mean, those guys I used to play cards with are probably still sitting in there right now. And I was released in 2005. And but for me, you know, getting released, you know, and people like, oh, you got through such hard times. Like, I didn't get through that on my own, you know. The program, you know, the people in the rooms, you know, a higher power that I choose to call God, they, all that carried me through that, you know. I probably wouldn't have made it through without AA. And I got released in 2005. And it was funny, too. They moved me to a work release camp. Just happened to be on the outskirts of Panama City Beach. Just happened to be a place where my sponsor Leo and Jerry took a meeting to every week. So I got to have my last few meetings down there in Florida with them. And it was one of those God moments, you know, for me. I had a lot of those. Didn't realize it then, but when I look back now, I can see where that stuff, those like God moments, you know. I wasn't the only young kid. There was another young kid down there that got sober. Or he was 5 years sober. I remember being in the rooms, and I'd see him across the room, and he kind of kept his distance from me. He was a painter. He always had paint all over him. And I'd always see him. And this was like, you know, I was only like 2 weeks into the meetings, and I remember coming out of my apartment on the beach, and he came out of his apartment. And what are the odds? Like, our doors faced each other in the middle of Sodom and Gomorrah. That's how this place was. It was. It's always in the news, and it's like, what are the odds? This kid lives across the street from me. Like, and we spent many a night. I come home from work, drive past 500 bars, and he'd be waiting on my porch, or I'd wait for him on his porch, and we kept each other sober, and we'd read literature and just talk about music or whatever. You know, it was just looking back, stuff like that, and. Just solidifies that, you know, there was something working in my life. And but when I was getting out, work called me up and said, Billy, we got the job, we got the title, we want you back, we could use you. And that was tough because people, places, and things is what they kept drilling into me. And all I knew for those 10 years or whatever was how to throw parties. My hands were on liquor every day. It's all I really knew how to do, and I was afraid. And I said, I can't do it. So I got my probation transferred back to Pennsylvania. As soon as I was released, I was put on a plane. And I moved in with my mother and father at the age of 31 in the room that they threw me out of. And 2.5 years sober, thinking, and that's what happens when I get up here. What is my life going to be like? You know, the guilt and shame of the past and the fear of the future and what time I have left, or everybody's so far ahead of me, or I'm so far behind the eight ball, you know. Like the gloom and doom, man. Like once, if I stay up in my head too long, it's crushing. And for me, I got a new sponsor because Leo said I can't help you from down here. You got to get a sponsor that's gonna, you know, keep you on your journey. And that's when I met my sponsor Timmy, and he was one of those guys. He just said, you know, get to a meeting every day, and I continued the steps with him, and. I started hanging out with a lot of young guys that had driver's licenses. I got the more meetings than people that had cars. I got involved in the Schwank. Last time, I think when I spoke up here last time, I was in Schwanksville, and I was like locked in down there, and I would always be hanging out with these guys, you know, just going to meetings every night, doing odds and end jobs, just trying to stay out of myself. Had a lot of coffee commitments and stuff like that. Had a hard time trying to carry the message to a lot of these. I didn't feel like I was a good teacher. You know what I mean? Like you can explain stuff to me, but me trying to explain the 12 steps to, you know, young guys, like I wasn't very good at it. Somebody turned me on to some Joe and Charlie tape meetings, and that's like Big Book for Dummies. That's how I felt like it. And I understood everything so clearly when I'd sit in those meetings. And then I'd leave and I'd forget. And I'd whack my head a lot. So I just make them come with me. And we'd go to the meetings. And it helped me immensely, you know, just trying to understand why we do these steps, you know, and the inventories. And for me, and I moved out of my mom and dad's house, you know, moved in with another sober alcoholic for a year and just put one foot in front of the other, you know, just trying to do the next right thing. I got a job working at some sales place in King of Prussia. I would take the SEPTA bus, you know, 3 hours a day, you know, an hour and a half in the morning and an hour and a half at night. And I'd go to this place, and I was there for 3 years. I ended up getting a sales position somehow. I got promoted to a sales position, and I didn't tell people I was in AA. I was always told, you're going around telling people you're in AA and you drink. The message you're carrying is that AA doesn't work. It's how we live and how we live this program. It's attraction, not promotion, you know. And I'd be sitting in my cubicle and people would come in to me and they'd be like, you know, Billy, I know you don't drink because we go to these functions and do these things and you're always drinking like a Coke. And I know you don't drive because you ride the SEPTA bus. And my colleagues, they all drove like Lexuses and Audis and stuff, and I'm taking SEPTA. And I only live in Roarsford, you know. And they're like, you know, I know you don't drive, and you must have done something pretty bad because you haven't been driving in like 3 years. But you seem happy. Can I talk to you about my son or my brother? Or, you know, I wouldn't lay it all on him. But, you know, I talked to them enough where, you know, I might be able to comfort them and give them some hope and maybe meet up with their loved, which I did, you know. Because I used to question that. Why am I here? What am I doing here? And then that kind of stuff. Somebody would come walking into my cubicle and I'm like, all right, I'll stop, you know. Because I was always asked that, you know. And people always have to remind me, like, you don't need to know what your primary purpose is to stay sober and help other alcoholics achieve sobriety. That's it. You know what I mean? That's your purpose. There is no secret thing going on here. You know, like that's God's job for you. You are one of the chosen to carry this message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for me, I paid off those $30,000 in funeral expenses in 3 years. Started thinking about all that money I was going to make then after that. And then the company got bought and I lost my job. But it's like I always had enough because I'm one of those guys, when I get money, I get in trouble. That's how it always was for me. You know, I start living high, but he always provided just enough. And there was food on the table. Bills got paid. You know, for me, you know, I'm truly blessed. You know, the biggest thing for me when I look back, it's like I don't know when it happened. But like I was a stone cold drunk. Like I thought of booze all the time, and when I didn't have it in me, you know, I was always thinking of the next drink, and the obsession. And somewhere along the line, like that obsession was lifted from me. You know, for me, it's the steps. I went a while without doing any kind of real step work or had any kind of real program. I got involved a lot going to just meetings and making lots of coffee for a period of time in my sobriety. And I get mean and I get angry and nasty and the people around me suffer. And I'm married today and I don't want to be that terrorist, you know. It's like I grew up in a house like that where it was very cold. And there was no I love yous. There was no hugs. And me and my little sister, we talk about it because she's 15 years sober. And because our spouses sometimes give us grief about it. And it's like, you know, to hug, when they lean in for a hug, we almost like kind of recoil because we're not used to that. Like, and the steps and through practicing the steps and you know I'm learning to I'm changing, you know what I mean. I'm learning compassion and how to be caring. And it's weird for me. And it's a daily thing. I grew up always hearing stories about I had a aunt. My father's father stopped drinking on his own back, I think, in the early days of AA. I don't know if AA ever got to him, but he stopped drinking, never left the house. He was a violent, violent man, I heard. My father found AA in 1977, and his older sister died from alcoholism at the age of 55. And his little brother, my Uncle John, who had 14 years sober at one point, had a mansion on the main line. He had a huge company. He got well and stopped going to AA, stopped working a program. And the wife left, the kids left, 4 DUIs in 1 year, a couple suicide attempts. I remember visiting him in a mission in Chester back in, like, I just got out of prison. I went with my dad to see him, and he was not the, he was like a shell. And I don't know if he was still drinking or what, but he died around the age of 55 too. That just tells me that no matter how good I sound or how well I might be today, you know, like my Uncle John, like, there ain't no guarantees. Like, I got to do this thing every day, because I'm going back to prison if I pick up a drink. And that's where I go. And I pray. I thank God every day that, you know, I'm on this side of the fence, and I have an opportunity. You know, I tried to live my life. You know what I mean? And I screwed that up. Now it's his life that, you know, I got to live it for him. You know, and Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life. It gave me a life. I got married last year. I was 39, I'll say. 38. We bought a home. Probably never drive again. State of Florida said nah to that, but you know what? You adapt, you learn. You know, I bought a house 2 blocks from where I work. And it's funny too, because the career path I'm on now, it's nice that I step out of the road and let somebody else run my life, because I make like twice as much as I did in the hotel business, working half as many hours with half the stress, you know. It's not about that, but it's funny, you know. I just feel like when I'm trying to do the next right thing, and when I look back at my life and how everything got to this point, like when I'm trying to do the next right thing, like everything, this formula has always worked for me. Everything just takes care of itself. If I got what I had wanted, I would have sold myself short. Because I'm living the dream today. And I'm grateful to be here, you know. And what I always try to share too, like, you know, no matter if you're in a situation, no matter how bad it might seem, you know, mine was pretty bad. I've heard guys that had a hell of a lot worse than me. But when they surrendered, you know, came into Alcoholics Anonymous, got a sponsor and worked the steps, you know, things turn around, you know, and, it's still possible, you know, it's still possible to turn around. And so with that, thanks for letting me share.
The group would like to thank Billy for sharing his experience with us tonight.